Welcome to University Drive, your pathway to the transformational work of University of the Bahamas. Our goal is to build a better Bahamas by shaping tomorrow's leaders today, finding solutions to challenges, and forging new opportunities for growth. University Drive, where faculty, staff, students, and alumni travel the road of progress together with you.
During the late night hours of Friday, May 13th, and the early morning hours of Saturday, May 14th, we experienced a record-setting rainfall that resulted in extreme flooding that saw many streets transformed to lakes, leaving many homes flooded, cars stalled, and Bahamians stuck indoors. This event was another reminder that climate change is real and that we here in the Bahamas are very much susceptible to the impact climate change is having the world over. My guest today is Kelly Armstrong, and before I get into her lists of accomplishments and titles, I must brag that she's a UB alumna. As a scientist and activist, she is the first Bahamian climate change professional certified by the Association of Climate Change Officers. She is the 2021 Climate Ambassador of the Global Youth Climate Network for the Bahamas and coordination team member for the first Climate Action Paper. Kelly is also the first Bahamian environmental professional registered with the Environmental Career Organization in Canada. She is also a Caribbean climate and disaster risk management researcher and an environmental scientist. Kelly, thank you so much for joining me on this week's episode of University Drive.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
Listen, Kelly, we are officially in the Atlantic hurricane season, and we've had our first scare already as to what this, you know, could possibly look like. We had that rain like 2-3 weeks ago. And then recently, the holiday weekend, we had a lot of rain, but we saw record rainfall and flooding in Florida, similarly here. And a lot of people are still skeptics that climate change is real. And for Bahamians, sometimes we don't know exactly what that looks like. Tell us, let's get into this conversation of climate change, sustainability, climate action, and doing our part, because from what I've gathered and what I'm reading, a lot of it is affected by what we as humans are or are not doing. What role have humans had over time in this drastic change we've seen in weather phenomenon known as climate change?
All right, so that's a lot to unpack, but I'm going to try. So when we talk about climate change, what we're really talking about, at least most of the time, is not anything natural. We understand that the Earth goes through different cycles and the climate has natural variations. But what we're talking about these days when we talk about climate change is actually anthropogenic or caused by humans, right? That's what that term means. And we've understood that over the last, let's say, I don't want to really put a time on it because it could be even longer than that, that we've actually, or that, you know, peoples have actually understood how the changes were connected, but certainly since the Industrial Revolution, right? We understand that a lot of those byproducts from the fossil fuel industry are enhancing the natural greenhouse gas effect of the Earth. And by enhancing it, what it's really causing is some of those gases that get emitted when we burn fossil fuels to get trapped in the upper layers of the atmosphere. And in turn, those gases trap the incoming solar radiation from the sun, which really manifests as heat, right? And as a result, that insulation comes into the Earth through that, it penetrates through that layer because it's coming in as short radiation. But once it penetrates through that layer and reaches the surface of the Earth, it's reflected back to the atmosphere and to space as long wave radiation that cannot penetrate back through that layer of gases. So it gets trapped as heat. All that energy gets trapped as heat. So the Earth is warming. And as you are aware, since the Industrial Revolution, global development has not slowed down, right? So we are continuing to emit and burn and all these fossil fuels, and therefore emit all these greenhouse gases that are piling up in the upper layers of the atmosphere and causing the Earth to get warmer and warmer progressively as time goes on. So what that's really calling for us to do is to stop all of that, which obviously is not very easy because it's ingrained into our culture now, right? That way of life, that dependency on fossil fuels and dependency on, you know, all of the products, not just, you know, oil and gas, but there's so many other products that are produced by fossil fuels, including plastics, right? So we have to take a serious step back and figure out alternatives for all of these industries that are based on all of these products, right? And obviously work together. As you would have mentioned, the impacts that we had recently, they're not isolated just to the Bahamas, but as a region, but even more powerful if we act globally, right? We make that decision to act globally, to try to fight climate change, to do what we can, to lobby for more sustainable development policies and practices, and really just try to save ourselves. Because the Earth is going to be all right, no matter what we do, the Earth will survive. She will protect herself. But what we're really trying to protect is our way of life. But we understand that our current way of life is not sustainable. And we have had sustainable ways of living in the past. So it's time for us to incorporate them into how we go about our daily lives now.
You said something that I want to come back to, that the Earth will sustain itself, right?
Absolutely. So when you think about it, just to touch on it a little bit. So when we think about, for example, a lot of the places that we resort to developing, because we have such small portions of really solid land, especially in the Bahamas, right? Our wetlands, right? We try to develop wetlands. Some people do it sustainably, some don't, right? But whenever there's a storm, that's when the true test, you get the true results of that test, right? To see if they really survive the impacts of the storm. The land always reclaims itself. The ocean will always reclaim itself. Wherever it once was is where it will return. And, you know, we use storms and other natural hazards to really determine how best, you know, some of those sustainable building practices are. And, you know, after the storm is when you really see the true results of that, interestingly. And you see it all the time and on different islands too, and not just in the Bahamas, you know. But yeah, it is very interesting. The Earth will definitely protect itself. It will reclaim her, she will reclaim her land, she will reclaim her ocean. And that's something that we have to be aware of. So we have to figure out how best to live with her.
So Kelly, let me put this in there based on what you just said. The land and the ocean always reclaim themselves. The Earth will sustain and protect itself. And I'm sure in recent weeks and even before, even with hurricanes of years gone by, we would have seen where, you know, when we have, and I'm not even talking about the type of storm surge that we saw with Dorian, but you know, like your typical category 2-3 hurricane back in the day, you know, in the 90s, early 2000s, where you would see where roads are along the coastline. And even recently with this last flooding that we had and rain, where it's almost like the road is giving way. And I guess it's because if that's where water was initially, and we fill it in, at some point that water will gravitate because that's its natural habitat. Am I understanding you correctly?
You are understanding me correctly, and you understand it correctly. Yes, that is absolutely correct. So let's not forget, between the marine habitat or the marine zone, the ocean, right, and the terrestrial habitat or terrestrial zone, there's a coastal zone where they're effectively allowed to transition one into another. So being an island, really and truly, especially from small, thin islands, all of our land can really be considered coastal zone, right? All of our land is in that transition between the ocean and the land, truthfully, right? So if we consider that, and we consider, you know, the supreme task that we have of trying to develop sustainably in that transitional zone where we understand that, you know, we are extremely susceptible to various natural hazards, then you understand a little bit better, you know, the supreme task that our builders, our construction professionals really have in trying to not just, you know, implement, but also maintain a lot of our infrastructure.
So are you saying, if you take a marine zone and you build, the built environment is constructed to become a terrestrial, the marine zone is built up to become a terrestrial zone. If something happens, that the automatic default is to make that a marine zone.
So basically the short answer is yes, right? So of course there are engineering interventions that we can use to ensure these structures are stable for some amount of time. They all come with caveats to say, you know, subject to, you know, a category two or less storm, right? And there may be some maintenance that's required afterward. But yes, eventually, if you have a hazard that's big enough, that's strong enough, the earth will reclaim its natural existence where it once was. It will return to it. She will protect herself. That is what I'm saying.
So is that why year after year after year, no matter what we do, we find that some areas, regardless of how clear the drains are, what human mitigation practices are put in place, they will always flood because they were initially marine zones, whether they were swamplands or wetlands that were built up, that now that they are considered terrestrial, that you cannot prevent the flooding from happening?
So yes and no, right? So you can prevent some flooding from happening because, again, there are some engineering or other, you know, interventions that you could potentially utilize. But again, do we actually have all of those at our disposal to even consider? That's the first thing, right? But yeah, I think, you know, the gist of it is, you know, we have to put a lot of things into context. So for example, when we look at the map of New Providence, right? A lot of people don't really have the opportunity to do that too often, but I do in my line of work. Half or perhaps even more than half of the island is wetland. All right, when we look at New Providence, Lake Killarney, truthfully, the middle of New Providence is really designated by Gladstone Road. And most of the area west of Gladstone Road is wetland. So when we consider that, understanding that, right, and understanding all the other smaller areas of wetland that we know that we've developed and that we expect flooding in, and we know that we can't mitigate for all of that flooding. On top of all that, you also have to consider one of my colleagues, Kendria Ferguson. She's also an environmental scientist, a sustainability professional who's studying her PhD right now. And she made a very interesting point. The Ministry of Works and Utilities had a press conference a couple of weeks ago to address some of the flooding concerns in the southern New Providence, right? Particularly at a new subdivision that was recently constructed. And their proposal was to basically construct these very deep wells deep in the earth, like 600 feet or so, for us to drain the water so that it's not as close to the surface, or it doesn't just go straight to the ocean, but it goes below the water table so as to not contaminate that either. And that's where we can put the water. But truthfully, that water is going to have to displace something, right? And at the end of the day, our water table is shallow anyway, whether or not we decide to develop wetlands, right? Our water table is shallow. It's usually within, you know, 3 to 10 feet of the surface, depending where you are on the island, right? Unless you're on like a really big hill. Then you also have to consider, again, climate change with sea level rise. The sea level is literally rising. So at the end of the day, we can try to put this water somewhere else, but the water is going to continue to rise. Flooding is going to continue to be a problem that we have to continue to deal with. So instead of using conventional construction practices, we really have to change the way that we look at building, period, if we want to continue developing this island.
So Kelly, what you just said is that flooding is inevitable, and that over time, you just won't have flooding from rain, but you'll also have flooding from sea level rise, which we know is happening, and that it's not about building drains anymore. It's really about how we redesign and reconstruct homes to accommodate this new, these weather patterns that are inevitable.
Yes, that is what I'm saying. And, you know, and again, there's, you know, there's so many factors to consider when we look at a construction project, time being one of them, right? But if you, if a lot of these construction projects, especially subdivision projects, weren't so, you know, stressed for time, they would have more opportunity to consult other professionals in the building space, like environmental professionals, like the ones that I work with, right? Who regularly perhaps work on larger infrastructure projects that require environmental impact assessments, so they can understand a little bit better what they could potentially do to help mitigate some of that flood risk.
Kelly, I have a question. Like you said, you just mentioned that whenever there are big projects, major developments, and environmental impact assessment is required, but it's not necessarily required for a small residential building. So let's just say I'm building a house. I purchase a property in a particular subdivision that's already been approved and outfitted with all of the infrastructure needed. I go to an architect. That architect isn't necessarily consulting an environmentalist. But are you saying that that is a practice that may be needed in the future as we figure out how to mitigate the built environment and what we're seeing as climate change?
So yes and no. Yes, because, well, let me start with the no. No, because at a certain level, all homes right now actually require what we call a certificate of environmental clearance. So there is something that all construction does require in terms of putting forward a preliminary permit application to the Department of Environmental Planning and Protection, which sits in the Ministry of Environment and Natural Resources, just to have a preliminary review of the project. And for that application, you actually have to provide quite a bit of environmental information. So there is a requirement for someone on your team to have some knowledge about some of the environmental baseline characteristics of your property. And hopefully it's someone who at least has the knowledge that, you know, your elevations in this area are particularly lower than others and you may be subject to flooding. But just to dig into that a little deeper, what we definitely encourage people to do, especially new homeowners who are in the process of constructing, when you buy a piece of property, even before you even clear anything down, after a rain, go and visit your property and see where the water is going. And take a note of that. And then after you clear your property, see what your risk of flooding is like. And again, just take notice of where your water is going. Because as you increase the amount of impermeable surface with all of that concrete and all of the other building materials on your property, your risk of flooding is only going to increase. So if it was flooding already when your property was still vegetated, then that's probably not a good sign. It's probably a sign that you will have to deal with some significant flooding, or perhaps you have to look at finding some other drainage solutions. And this isn't necessarily something you have to take on as an individual. You could take this on as a neighborhood project, right? But yes, that is something that you will have to pay close attention to. And then on the yes side, right? I say that because even though these all these steps are required, doesn't mean that everybody's following them, right? So there are still, you know, some loopholes that people tend to get through from time to time, or it could just be, you know, just you know, plain old ignorance, just a lack of knowledge, not really understanding what are the things to look for to really help keep them, their homes and their property safe.
That brings us to our first break here on University Drive. When we come back, I want to talk about, you know, some of the aspects of climate change and which ones we here in the Bahamas will be more susceptible to and need to pay more attention to. And then, of course, I want to get into what we as humans can do to delay. I guess we can't eliminate it, but what we can do to our part in fighting this global warming and climate change. We take our first break here on University Drive. We'll be right back.
My name is Nicolette Bethel, and I'm a 2022 Wilson Award grant recipient. It's called Spatial Justice in the Postcolonial Bahamas. That's a working title. I'm not sure what the final title is going to be. So this is something that has been interesting me for a long time, how we make sense out of or don't make sense out of the land we live in, the space we occupy, and how we continue to oppress ourselves through our organization of space and geography. Well, okay, so it's important for a couple of reasons. One, it's invisible. It's almost totally invisible and we don't realize when we're replicating it. Two, because we're an archipelago and we're the only archipelago of this size and magnitude in the Atlantic. Three, because our archipelago is really big and the Bahamas is actually the biggest country in the Caribbean, but we never think of it like that because we're always thinking about islands. But when you put all the islands together, spread across all the water, we're the biggest country in the Caribbean. We're big. Hopefully, what I have to say will uncover new ideas, possibly break new ground. Spatial justice isn't an entirely new thing, but there's only a couple of us working in this arena in this country right now. So I would hope that it shifts a conversation and puts UB at the center of that conversation.
For more on the Wilson Awards and the Wilson Grants to Fuel Bahamian Research, contact grants@ub.edu.bs.
Chapter One Bookstore is your back-to-school headquarters. We are proud to serve the students, faculty, and staff of the University of the Bahamas and the community at large. We are the premier choice for the purchase of university textbooks and supplies and UB logo apparel, paraphernalia, and gifts. We also carry a wide variety of school supplies, learning aids, and leisure books. Visit our coffee center throughout the semester for all of your printing, copying, and binding needs. Chapter One Bookstore is located on the ground floor of the Michael Eldon Complex. Shop with us on Monday through Friday between the hours of 8:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. Call us at 397-2650 or email us at chapter1@ub.edu.bs. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Chapter One Bookstore. See you soon.
Hi, I'm Sonia Farmer, and I'm a 2022 Wilson Award grant recipient. So my research project is called Indelible, and it's an oral history archive documenting experiences with and within citizenship, with and within the Bahamas. And this project is composed of three parts. Overall, it's a digital humanities project, but there is an oral history archive, which contains testimonies engaging with experiences with citizenship in this country. The second part is a collaborative art project where the participants also complete an altered voter's card however they would like. And the third component is an educational framework which provides toolkits so that we can engage with the crisis of citizenship in this country. So even though I'm coordinating this project and I've conceptualized this project, it's really primarily a collaborative project. I will be working with at least 50 different people speaking to me about their experiences with citizenship to make up this oral history archive. And I will also be working with historians, artists, human rights lawyers, and many other folks to create educational frameworks on the website as well so that we can engage with the history of citizenship and the current reality of citizenship. So it's really a collaborative project, and I'm really excited to be bringing everyone together to examine what it means to be Bahamian.
For more on the Wilson Awards and the Wilson Grants to fuel Bahamian research, contact grants@ub.edu.bs.
Welcome back to University Drive. I'm your host, Nikki Bowen. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Ms. Kelly Armstrong, who is a Caribbean climate and disaster risk management researcher and an environmental scientist. And if you know Kelly, you know that she's a climate ambassador. She is all about sustainable development. Anything sustainable, anything relating to climate action, she is your person. And before the break, we were talking about, you know, some of the recent weather patterns we've experienced here in the Bahamas as it relates to record rainfall and flooding and even sea level rise and what that means for us as a country. And something that Kelly said that was really astounding to me is that half of New Providence is wetland. And she says many people may not notice it, but you know, I it's something that I observed. I couldn't kind of calculate it. But of course, whenever you take off from Sir Lyndon Pendling International Airport, you can actually see how much of that area in particular that you referenced, Kelly, and you were talking about anything west of Gladstone Road, how much of that really is wetland. And so that means we're very susceptible to flooding. But so many other things have been happening, not just in the Bahamas, but around the world. We would have seen tornadoes, record-setting tornadoes in Alabama and across the Midwest United States earlier this year, where, you know, people were dying and it was like 15 tornadoes in such a short period of time. You'd have seen record snowfall in parts of the United States earlier this year, and even in Europe. And then there were even deadly snowstorms there was flooding in Malaysia in January. In February, there were ice events and snowstorms in Texas from New Mexico to New England and New York. There was also massive flooding in Malaysia. There were heat waves in Antarctica. So you go from extreme cold to extreme heat. And then in March, India had its hottest month in 122 years. There were tropical cyclones in Mozambique. Tornado warnings in Alabama hit record high. And so we see these things happening all over the world, from extreme cold to extreme heat, to flooding, to drought, to wildfires. I'm going to give a list of some of the climate change that is expected to happen globally, or that can be expected. And I want us to talk about which ones we need to be concerned about here in the Bahamas. And then we're going to transition our conversation to what we can do. So they talk about heat. Is heat something we need to be concerned about?
Oh, absolutely. Heat-related illnesses are very present in our community. I know, for example, when I was growing up, and my mom started going through what we call the change, I used to make fun of her, right? But I cannot imagine older women going through menopause, younger women going, or adults in general going through puberty, a hurricane coming and us not having a fan, let alone air conditioning, for weeks or months on end. Now, that would cause anyone to be extremely miserable if that happened now. So can you imagine if we were to experience even hotter air temperatures? Heat-related illnesses is definitely something that's probably not on the top of everybody's minds when they think about climate change, but it is definitely one of probably the worst climate change health-related impacts that we definitely have to prepare for. And I know as a region, our medical sector is definitely doing their best to prepare as reasonably as they can. Dr. William Hamilton and his team had a conference, was it last month or month before last, called Code Green, and they were talking about preparing for for climate change. And that is definitely on their list of things to do. They are very aware. And remember, it's not just heat stroke and things like that, but because the temperature is rising, you have to, you know, think a little bit further down the line. Because the temperature is rising, that also means that you have risks of, you know, for example, more systems that depend on cool energy systems to keep them cool so that they can operate properly. They have a higher risk of shutting down if they have to experience more hot ambient temperatures more regularly, right? So all of those things you have to consider. And don't forget, some of our equipment that we use in hospitals is very sensitive equipment. And it's usually very expensive and rare equipment. So it's not necessarily, you know, God forbid, if someone was depending on, their life was depending on a particular machine and that machine was inoperable, then they would have to be airlifted. You know, all of those things come into play. So yes, heat-related illnesses is a huge one. And it will take the medical sector. They will spend a lot of time and a lot of money, a lot of resources trying to prepare to deal with those.
Kelly, you just opened up a whole can of worms and something that I never even thought about. And you mentioned this phrase, climate change, health-related impacts. So we're not just seeing an impact of climate change on our natural environment or our built environment. Climate change is also going to impact our health.
Oh, absolutely. Climate change impacts every sector. Every sector, you name it, and I can give you a list of impacts for sure. There's nothing that climate change is not going to impact.
So let's move on to the next one. Rain and flood. I mean, we've already seen it, so it's almost a no-brainer. This is something that's been very recent and in our face. How much are we going here in the Bahamas as a small island developing state going to be impacted by rain and flood?
That's also a huge one for us to think about and that we need to have more conversations about. Because when we talk about rain, it's very interesting because rain is probably one of the hardest things to forecast accurately. And yet it is probably one of the most sought after forecasts. So it's very interesting. So with climate change, we understand that our temperatures are getting warmer. But what we're not sure about is how that's actually going to translate in terms of our precipitation impacts. So two things can happen. It can get hotter, which means that there will be more evaporation off the surface of our oceans, which means we'll have more water making clouds and potentially more rain. However, we don't really know how that rainfall, what that rainfall pattern is going to look like. So we could just have more rain like during the rainy season, or we could have more rain outside the rainy season, or we could have more rain in these like flash flood type of events, right? So that's a very difficult one. And we really just have to be prepared for anything. And by that, I mean, we really have to rely on our other areas of knowledge of what flood impacts we can anticipate, as opposed to worrying about how or when the rain is going to fall in order to try to mitigate some of our risk against floods. Now, so that's when we talk about rain, but there are obviously other types of flooding that we also have to prepare for. There's what we call a storm surge, right? So again, due to climate change, the air gets hotter and a lot of that heat is actually absorbed from the air into our oceans. And our ocean's response to that is it actually swells up a little bit. So our sea level pressure and our sea level height increases, which means that when we have a storm, our storm surge will also be higher because the water level is higher, right? So again, sea level rise, flooding from that is incremental. It's very gradual. It's not something that you'll notice from day to day, but as we move from season to season, year to year, decade to decade, you'll notice our storm surge has a marked increase, all right, as sea level rise continues. So that's sea level rise flooding. But then you also have, a lot of anthropogenic influence, perhaps caused by these flash flood events that are a combination of heavy rainfall in a short period of time, but as well just due to our natural geography, where again, we have these very shallow aquifers or water lenses, groundwater lenses, very close to the surface where, you know, we live our lives. And so it doesn't take a lot of rain or a lot of storm surge in order for us to have reached, you know, for the ground to reach its full capacity of absorbing some of that water, and eventually flooding will result because the ground just can't absorb any more water. And then again, we also have to be cognizant of, you know, all of our deforestation and make sure that that's properly regulated, because we want to at some point be able to achieve some balance with planting activities, right? So our conservation or restoration or planting of forests, we want to balance that with our harvesting of forest resources so that we can ensure that this water is absorbed not just by the soil, because we know that our soil layers aren't very thick, but also the trees, right? The trees can use that water. The trees can use that those greenhouse gases that we're emitting, and they can use that to create food for themselves, produce oxygen for us to breathe. So it has a plethora of benefits, but we want to look at all of these issues as holistically as we can.
Wow, you said a whole lot there, and a lot for us to think about and consider as we move into, as we coexist with this climate change in our new reality. What about drought? We've seen where some places are very dry, arid, there's been no rainfall. So we're on one side of the world, or, you know, one region is experiencing record rainfall and another region is having no rainfall at all. And you said rain is probably one of the hardest things to forecast accurately. And we don't know the impact of precipitation. And you went through that whole water cycle. That took me back to high school biology and science.
Right.
And so what can we expect or anticipate drought, or is that something that we will be faced with, or not necessarily, or we don't know?
Oh, absolutely. Drought impacts are definitely something that we face, and it's probably something that a lot of people don't realize, because we're a coastal nation, right? And we feel like, oh, we see the water every day, water is very accessible, not really realizing how much we pay or don't pay for water, right? Our freshwater resources that come through our pipes in our homes are heavily subsidized by the Water and Sewage Corporation. So that's another conversation for another day. But when we talk about water, when we talk about the lack of water through drought, so obviously one way that our freshwater resources, our groundwater aquifers get recharged is through rainfall. And again, we had discussed previously that, again, rainfall is one of the hardest things to predict. And with climate change changing rainfall patterns, we may see fewer rainfall events, but they will be large in terms of volume of rainfall that we get at a time. So that means that if the rainfall events are fewer and further in between, that means that in between those periods, we're really going to be experiencing periods of drought, right? And so normally from November to, or rather December to April is typically a dry season. And then May to October is really a wet season, and November to April is a dry season here in the Bahamas, right? And so we have to be aware of how dry these seasons really are. So we had a record dry season, I think, for the last few years. And believe it or not, some of other Caribbean countries that further south in the region especially have been in a drought for decades, right? So that is something that we can potentially, prepare for, not just because of the unpredictable rainfall, but also, again, when you think about the other hazards that we're exposed to, like storms, again, our freshwater lenses are very shallow to the surface of the land. And we have to consider that when we have storm surge impacts and other coastal flooding events, that they salinize, they basically salty up our freshwater resources. Therefore, we have to resort to, you know, other stores of freshwater or potentially, you know, source them from elsewhere. So yeah, drought is a very serious thing. And don't forget, you know, we do have agriculture industry in the Bahamas that where some people really do rely just on rainfall or, you know, fresh groundwater to support their agricultural ventures. And so we have to consider impacts to that industry as well.
Okay, so this one may seem far-fetched, but I can't rule it out because you just don't know what's going to happen as it relates to climate change. Cold and snow.
Right. So as it relates to cold, I'm not too sure that that will be an issue. Although, again, climate change is all about extremes, right? So in the past, you know, we've definitely seen a few hail events, especially in Western Grand Bahama. From time to time, we get those odd weather events. And when it comes to snow, I don't think we've recorded snow in the Bahamas for the last 30 years, maybe 35 years or so. But they're definitely possible. The extremes on both ends of the spectrum are definitely possible. They're less likely, but they're still possible.
Storms. I guess for that, it's inevitable. And I think the question that we really should be asking ourselves as it relates to storms, because we live in a hurricane belt, so we know that we are going to be experiencing storms, is the, I guess, the intensity and the frequency of the storms versus whether or not they will happen.
So what we've been seeing recently is not necessarily an increase in the number of storms, but certainly an increase in the intensity of storms, which is very scary because, again, like a couple of years ago when we went through Hurricane Dorian, no one in the Bahamas alive right now has ever experienced anything like that. And so we joked around, we were calling it a Category 6, but that is seriously being considered whether or not we need to develop another level of category strength to describe, you know, these hurricane impacts like Dorian. So yes. Storm intensity is definitely increasing. And again, that is due to the oceans absorbing a lot of the heat due to climate change, and the heat of that, of these oceans being the fuel that really drives these hurricanes. In the Bahamas, we have shallow waters. That's what Bahamas means, right? Baja Mar, shallow seas. It's Spanish, right? And so it doesn't really take a lot for our waters to heat up. Right. If you just think about the sun beaming on them all day, let alone absorbing heat from the atmosphere. So, yeah, it's that it sort of explains why our hurricane seasons tend to be so active. I mean, we pray to God we won't have, you know, actual landfall on an island, which will do more damage. But yeah, even just a passing hurricane can still do a lot of damage depending on, you know, which quadrant of the hurricane passes by one of our islands. But yes, yeah, certainly it's something that we're going to have to continue to prepare better and more for coming into the future. And again, we're not going to be able to do that without looking at this, the issues that stem from the impacts as holistically as possible.
One of the things as it relates to climate change that, you know, is of major concern is sea level rise. What does that mean for us as a small island developing state and one that's so, you know, that's so low lying?
So that basically means that instead of thinking, you know, perhaps, you know, you understand that you are building in a low lying area, perhaps your foundation needs to go up another foot or two more. You are thinking rather, you know, you are on the close to the coast. You can be impacted by coastal flooding. You know that heavy rainfall events during the rainy season are very likely. So you can suffer from, you know, inland flooding. Perhaps you live close to a wetland too, or developing in a wetland itself, right? So all of that you need to consider. So rather than putting your elevation up 1 or 2 feet, and you know that's going to be completely solid, completely impermeable, you might want to consider building your house on stilts, right? So at least if you have any flooding under your house, it won't impact the house itself, and it still has an opportunity to have more surface area anyway to be absorbed by the ground underneath.
Wildfires, we've seen homes, million-dollar homes and mansions in California and that region being destroyed by wildfires. Is that something that we here need to be concerned about?
I think we can be concerned about it, but not too overly concerned, because unfortunately, a lot of our areas are becoming deforested, as at least, you know, here in Providence. However, a lot of our wildfires are really started by, you know, just waste in the forest. So waste management is definitely an issue. Like, you know, we had several educational campaigns back in the past about, you know, not throwing your bottles in the bush. And, you know, you could remember from like third grade science, you leave a magnifying glass on a dry piece of bush long enough, it'll start a fire, just the heat energy, right? So that's also kind of connected to drought as well. But fire management is definitely more of a concern than, say, you know, just wildfires as a result of drought, at least here in Providence. So when I say wildfire management, a lot of people don't realize that wildfires are a natural process in the life of a forest, particularly forests that produce natural oils like pine forest. So what happens is over time, oil resins tend to build up in the soil, and they naturally will catch fire and burn out those resins so that younger trees and seedlings can grow up to become older trees, because they can't necessarily grow in that saturated environment. So it's a natural process. And a lot of times when people try to manage wildfires and they manage them poorly, where they don't let enough of those oils or resins burn out of the soil or burn out of the ground, what happens is they continue to store up, and then you have a fire that you can't control. So in the Bahamas, I believe that our firefighters have some training, have the requisite training, where as long as it's not threatening anyone's homes or any lives, they just tend to let it burn and they just control it on that front. Obviously, if it gets too close to someone's home and it threatens, you know, people's safety, then they'll do a little bit more control. But generally speaking, at least in Grand Bahama, where I've grown up, I know that's the practice that they use.
Ecosystem function. When we talk about climate change, we know that we live in an ecosystem. Everything is dependent upon the other. There's this, you know, hierarchy of things, whether it's in the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom, whatever it is. We're all interconnected. How is climate change impacting ecosystem functions?
So that's a good question. So ecosystems have several different functions. We use them, or rather we acknowledge that they are regulating systems. They regulate certain functions and systems, natural systems of the earth. They provide not just regulating functions, but also recreation. They have inherent value, right? And so when we talk about climate change and we talk about things being interrupted, like the water cycle, the carbon cycle, those really end up in interrupting ecosystem functions as well, because all of these things are naturally parts of life, and that these cycles are things that need to happen in order for life to go on. And so when you have interruptions in them is when you would have what we call disasters, right? So it's very important to recognize that climate change has an impact on everything, not just natural systems, but also human systems, and the way that we, you know, both of those systems interact with each other. So when we think about ecosystem function, again, we could just think about, for example, you know, let's just pick an issue. So for example, you're talking about sea level rise, right? So again, greenhouse gases, because of fossil fuel emissions, get trapped in, more of them get trapped in the air, in the upper layer of the atmosphere. Heat from the sun comes in, can't come out, so it gets trapped. That causes the global temperature to rise, causes global ocean temperatures to rise, and the actual height of the oceans to rise, which causes sea level rise, which allows for more storm surge, inundation, and flooding, which means that the ground will get saltier, right? And I like this example because this is probably one that a lot of Bahamians don't really think about. So let's talk about it. So if we have more storm surge and more coastal flooding and more coastal erosion, that means we're going to have less and less forestry resources, because that what we've designated is that transition zone, that coastal zone, is already under threat due to development. And then we have all of this coastal flooding, all this coastal erosion that's actually literally taking away what's left of that natural infrastructure. So the natural environment that's left on the terrestrial side keeps becoming flooded with salt water. So naturally, that's going to not be able to tolerate too much of that, and it's going to transition into more of the coastal zone. But we already could imagine. So if we think about forestry, right? Forestry is obviously a terrestrial resource, for the most part anyway, because mangroves can also be considered forestry resources. We think about the soil and the roots of all the systems of all the plants and other vegetative matter that help to keep the soil together, right? But if imagine that being subjected to coastal flooding and coastal erosion, it keeps getting worn and worn away. Eventually, that area is just going, the only thing that can really survive there is sand or coastal plants and vegetation, right? So we're going to lose our forestry resources and all of the biodiversity that depends on those forestry resources, which means that it's going to essentially start a negative feedback system where, you know, we lose our forestry resources and they're not going to be able to do anything with the increased amount of carbon dioxide in our air due to these fossil fuel emissions that are causing climate change either. So all of the carbon dioxide that they've been able to use and sequester into the soil, into their roots and their plant matter, that's going to be released back into the earth. And that means that the heat effect is going to be worse, that the oceans are going to be hotter and higher, and we're going to have even more potential for storm surge flooding and even more potential for coastal erosion and lose even more terrestrial forestry resources. So you understand why climate change has an impact on everything. So those are the negative feedback systems that we're trying to put a wrench in by advocating for climate action. And we really have to look at that again, not just at a holistic level, by considering all of these different disciplines and ecosystem functions and professionals who work in these spaces to conserve and protect these resources. But we also have to consider that this is not an issue that any one country can address on their own. So while, yes, as the Bahamas, we want to be a leader for other big ocean states, right? We also have to continue to encourage some of the larger nations that are emitting most of the greenhouse gases, really encourage them and lobby for them and to sign on to these like global policy frameworks that really try to fight climate change and therefore some of its impacts, because we are going to suffer and we're going to suffer greatly. So we're really just trying to protect ourselves, because like I said, the earth will protect herself.
So Kelly, you mentioned climate action and advocating for climate action. What does that advocacy look like, and what does it mean for us as ordinary citizens?
The two approaches that I like to talk about are the bottom-up and the top-down approach, right? Hoping that, you know, whichever one any person in particular might prefer, that our efforts meet somewhere in the middle to really affect change. So when we think about the bottom-up approach, that means you as an individual, what can you do? So you can make more sustainable choices. For example, especially if you're in a position to make a large purchase in your life, whether that be like a home or a car, you know, consider buying an electric vehicle. If you're going to build a home, consider all of the, you know, smart choices that you can make to make your home as green as possible, as energy efficient as possible. Perhaps if you live in a flood-prone area, you do want to consider perhaps, putting your home up on stilts or something of the sort. Or if you live in a coastal area close to the beach, maybe you want to, consider an extra couple hundred feet of setback from the ocean just to protect yourself from impacts, right? Because I don't want anybody to become a statistic, right? So those are things that you can do on an individual level. On a community level, what are some things that you could do? Just as communities get together to do anything else, like have a fun day or anything, all of that considers and requires planning. You can plan to have a climate risk vulnerability assessment for your community. You can know where some of the weak spots are where flooding occurs. You can know where some of the homes are that may be older and more susceptible to impacts from hurricanes that, perhaps this person may need a hurricane clip or two just to help secure her roof. Like, those are things that you can do together as a community. You can do tree planting exercises, as I've done in the past, with your members of parliament on your parks, right? Because again, when we talk about those heat related illnesses and we go out to our parks, we need to ensure that there are places in our community where people don't just go to exercise or meat, but also perhaps forage. If you plant some native fruit trees, and particularly the larger trees, perhaps you could even go there and, get some relief from the shade and enjoy a longer day on the park playing with your kids instead of having to go home when it gets too hot, right? So things like that help to sort of decrease our impacts due to climate change. And then as a nation, right, you continue to support, our STEM professionals who want to implement and develop with sustainable infrastructure, who go to all of these multilateral conferences and lobby on our behalf. They're really doing it not for themselves, they're doing it for us, because they realize that, our nation is at risk of, these are things that are necessary for our survival, and we really need everybody's help. And then just education-wise, we need to ensure that we put into our curriculum, climate change, science and studies, like, let's let our kids know that these are some risks that they're going to expose to more and more as they come into adulthood. These are some of the risks that they're going to have to manage on their own. And it's a part of life now. And so we need to teach them and prepare them to deal with that. So hopefully if we continue to really, focus on all of those efforts together, we can make a real change. But it's definitely going to be at the top, a collaborative effort between nations of the world. And so we just have to encourage people doing those negotiations to just get everybody on our side.
This has been a very, very, very interesting and timely conversation. I know we can always have you on our show. And I think we will bring you back to talk about some more things, because there's a whole lot that we didn't get to touch on. But I'm very pleased with the direction this show went in, and it was very enlightening and eye-opening. Thank you so much for joining me on this week's episode of University Drive.
Thank you all again for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk about these things I'm very passionate about. And I just want to go ahead and put in a plug, if anybody is really interested in following these conversations, I have them a little more often. I tend to post things on my Instagram page. So the handle is @ I Speak Climate 242. And I also repost the same content on my LinkedIn page if anyone else is interested in more of these types of conversations and discussion topic starters. I'm happy to answer any questions, and let's take some climate action together.
Thank you for that. And that's @ISpeakClimate242, correct?
That's correct.
Thank you so much to my listening audience for joining us on this week's episode of University Drive. Be sure to check out our website at www.ub.edu.bs. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And of course, be sure to join us same time, same radio station for another insightful episode of University Drive next week. Thank you so much. I'm your host, Nikki Bow. Enjoy the remainder of your day.
University Drive is a production of the Office of University Relations and the Communications and Creative Arts Academic Unit at University of the Bahamas. All rights reserved.